We are now on frequently asked question number 18. Questions up on the board: what about abortion, euthanasia, and capital punishment? And if you would, the material was handed out 2 weeks ago. And there may be some in the back. I intended to look, but I got caught up in the front with the projector. I needed to work correctly. This is a little bit messed up. If you don't have a copy, of course, the material is going to be up on the board, but there should be a few handouts left in the back. Right there, Jonathan's got them in the back. Anybody need a copy, just raise your hand. Until they're gone, we'll hand them out. Appreciate that. We're going to be again discussing these three separate issues under one heading. And if we were to give a broad general title to it, it would have something to do with what the Bible teaches concerning life, or respect for life, or man's dealings with the issue of life and death. And these three impact in three different ways, but they're all what we might refer to as hot button issues in our society, especially the case in Texas with regard to the question of abortion. As you know, just recently the Texas legislature passed a law that restricts abortions in a number of different ways. If I understand it correctly, the most obvious one is that it would restrict abortions after 20 weeks, which is 5 months pregnancy. In addition to that, there's some restrictions placed upon both doctors as well as the facilities where the abortions would be performed. And that's a stopgap measure, no doubt about it, in regard to the legality of abortion and the practice of abortion. It was in 1973 that the federal government legalized abortion within certain parameters that have, in the interim, been interpreted very loosely, allowing abortion for just about any reason. Euthanasia is something that has, from time to time, been a topic of conversation in our society. All of you are familiar with Dr. Kevorkian and his desire to give dignity in death to individuals who were hurting, and assisted suicides, and was charged with murder as a result of those things. And then, of course, capital punishment that is practiced in Texas for a while was illegal and considered unconstitutional, but that was overturned, is presently constitutional and practiced in many states. The three should not necessarily be lumped together in the sense of all three right or all three wrong. In fact, the writer of the material, which you know to be Jeff Smith, he's preaching at Woodmont, he takes the position that capital punishment is something authorized by God, whereas the other two are not. And we'll discuss those things. But these are things, these are the types of things that people are going to be asking you about matters, if not of religion, of ethics, come up. And of course they have an impact, because whenever we discuss questions like this, the question that we ask is, what does God's word say about it? What does God have to say about it? Because we're going to respect that. And there are some different views as to what the Bible has to say or does not have to say on the matter. So we want to examine these questions in light of what the Scriptures teach. Okay? So the first thing we want to do is define it, and I'm going to have to be turning around because I forgot to put the slide up on the... I usually put a copy of the slide here so I can face you, but I forgot to do that. So the first thing is defining abortion. And these definitions, again, come from the article that was written. Abortion is the disruption of the development of an unborn human being, resulting in the termination of life. Again, a definition that would be somewhat under dispute, but I do believe that regardless of how that life is defined, there is at least that acknowledgement on the part of all that whether it be tissue or whether it be an appendage of the mother, or whether it be an actual human being that is alive. Whatever it is, it's alive. It's something biologically, the definition of that's very clear. And so we can talk about that a little bit more. What abortion is, the termination of pregnancy, which results in the loss of the fetus. So this definition, of course, is what I'd be comfortable with, one that others may not. The second is defining euthanasia. Euthanasia is the intentional termination of life for the purpose of eliminating suffering. The common term that is used for euthanasia is mercy killing. And the contention is that an individual who has lost a normalcy in his life cannot have a sufficiently a life that has sufficient quality because of pain or because of some reduced abilities, that in a situation like that, that they should have the right to terminate their own life or to have assistance in the termination of their life as an act of mercy. There are, however, might I add, individuals who advocate that doctors should have that choice. That's something that is an adjunct to this concept of euthanasia. Those who are in a position of authority as regards to medical know-how and knowledge, that they're the ones that should be given the right to make decisions with regard to life and death. And there are many who advocate that. So it's a very contentious issue as well. Yes,
and I would take issue a little bit with that definition, because it's much broader than to just eliminate suffering. Sometimes it is to eliminate problems for other people. That someone says their quality of life is diminished, placing a burden on me, and therefore, so.
Yeah, and often even when you're talking to an individual who desires to take their own life, terminate their own life, it's not particularly because they're in great pain, but because of the burden that they place upon others. And so that would be a little bit more broad. Maybe the suffering is not theirs, but So we can broaden that definition a bit as well. These are somewhat arbitrary, so we get the idea in front of us, and we don't have to be dogmatic about the wording of any of them. Then the third thing is capital punishment. And we want to distinguish between this taking of life to ensure that it is by governmental decree. And we read from Romans, the 13th chapter, that the king or those who are in authority are God's agents with regard to the sword. And we'll talk a little bit about that later. But it is the intentional termination of human life by governmental decree. And that is from a criminal, an individual who has committed a capital offense. And, of course, different cultures define what capital offenses are. Not every government, not every nation is in agreement as to what constitutes a capital offense. But that is the third definition. So anybody have any questions, comments about any of those three definitions so that we'll know exactly what it is that we're talking about? Yes, Chris. Yeah, we're going to have to talk about that. That's actually, you're getting into the meat very, very quickly. What Chris was asking is, where do you draw the line between what we might refer to as euthanasia and then something that, DNR, do not resuscitate, order that may be given, or the living wills where individuals say no superhuman efforts to be made to keep an individual alive in some artificial manner, or to resuscitate if they reach their particular point. So we need to answer that question, but it's going to take just a little bit of time as we get into it, and we will take the time to discuss these things. I kind of like to go at it a little bit more systematically. So this week or next, we'll actually try our best to answer that question. And this is one of the reasons why this is a contentious topic, because there are gradations that exist with all of these things. So you say, I'm for capital punishment. Well, are you for capital punishment for murder? Yes. Are you for capital punishment for rape? Well, So it's a yes, and the other says, well, I don't know. And then you go on down through and you try to define these things. Okay, what about euthanasia? Well, what if it's this particular instance? What if it's another particular instance? What about abortion? One of the primary aspects of abortion is that the majority, even who would say that they're against abortion, will make exceptions with regard to, again, the question comes up is with regard to rape. It's a very emotional issue. So those things arise. And certainly, they can muddy the waters. But I think that as we look at the principles themselves and what the scriptures have to say about this, and look at it somewhat logically with the point of view, and it's all predicated upon the fact that God is the one who defines and determines the parameters of life and what is acceptable with regard to the taking of human life, so on and so forth, that if we follow those, that a lot of the problems that come in these discussions, the hardships with regard to really digging down and determining what your belief is going to be on the matter, that is clarified. And one of the reasons why it's so difficult is because too many are governed by what seems right to them. In other words, these are very visceral things, and so they have a very visceral impact when they're brought up, when the exceptions are brought up. The idea of fairness is almost invariably brought up as a part of them. When you start talking about with capital punishment, that a disproportionate number of minorities are executed in America. So now we've got an issue of fairness that may cloud the issue with regard to these things. And all of these things are difficult. And again, they can color our thinking and sometimes muddy the water. But there are some principles that we want to establish from Scripture that will help clarify those things. That will be very helpful. David, did you ask?
Well, hold off until we get into week two or three or four.
You think it's going to take that long? No telling. We'll see. Anybody else with regard to the definitions? Okay, let me see what else is up here. Of the three, only capital punishment is approved of in Scripture. That's the contention that is made by Ben Smith in the article. And Romans chapter 13 is used as a means of establishing that. Just very quickly, turn with me there. Just want to make note of one or two points. This is the Christian's call to be obedient to the civil government. Question arises and certainly was at issue during the days of Christ and the apostles as to what our response should be to secular government in the understanding and realization that often secular government can be somewhat opposed to the Christian faith and that there can be conflicts and all that happens in those circumstances. The first time that I can think of, there may be others that come to mind later, but the first time I can think of was when Jesus was tested with regard to taxation. And was asked as to whether they should pay taxes to Caesar. Now, of course, the Jew recognized that Rome was an evil empire. The Gentiles were full of ungodliness, and the list in Romans chapter 1 was characteristic of the Roman government and hierarchy. And there was much evil that was being done even at that time in which this question was asked of Jesus. And you'll remember Jesus' response as he asked for them to bring a Roman coin. And he said, whose inscription is it on the coin? It's a Caesar's. He said, render unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's, unto God the things that are God's. Which, again, is an indication, very clearly, that he believed that they should, or taught that they should, pay taxes to Rome. So this was a civil responsibility. Now, what is the limit? That's one of the questions that will be asked. Let's see. It's actually the second question on the page concerning the Christian's response to laws that would require him to do something that is ungodly. What is our response to that? So there may be a limitation as to how much obedience we're to render to Caesar. But the Apostle Paul is the one that perhaps has the most full explanation of our responsibility to the civil government. The interesting thing about this is the statement made that the civil government is not an enemy to those who are righteous. And I think that we all can see that this is the case. There are not many in this number that I'm aware of that have been incarcerated or been arrested or gotten into trouble with the law. I mean, someone may have gotten a speeding ticket or two or done something else wrong. But as far as the concern when you go down the street that you may be tapped on the shoulder by a police officer and slapped in handcuffs is not something we have to greatly concern ourselves with in our country at this point in time. Because the laws of the land are kept by Christians. And that's the point that is being made here in the text. We're told in verse 2, for example, whoever resists authority resists the ordinance of God. Those who resist will bring judgment on themselves. For rulers are not a terror to good works, but evil works. Do you want to be unafraid of the authority? Do what is good, and you will have praise from the saint. And that's generally the case. Now, having said that, we recognize that the apostles were thrown into prison. Paul, specifically, as is related in the latter part of the book of Acts, he was thrown into prison because he was preaching the faith. So there are exceptions to that. But in general, laws are in place for the purpose of keeping people from obeying or behaving in bad ways, destructive to society. Christians, because of their responsibility to God and their obedience to the gospel, do not behave in ways that are destructive to society. And so, in general, a Christian will not have to concern himself with the governing authorities. And that's generally the case. It has been generally the case over the entirety of the history of mankind, through the history from man's creation till today. Not to say that there aren't exceptions to it, but he's talking about the general rule here in this particular text. But there are a couple of things you want to note also in this text. In the first verse, every soul is to be subject to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except from God. The authorities that exist are appointed by God. Well, that indicates that it's not that God necessarily approves of them, that if they're in office, that means that God's on board with what they're doing. But that God ultimately is in control. In Acts chapter 17, it is God who is the one who establishes both the rise and fall of nations as well as the boundaries of their habitation. And as long as these nations or these authorities are in power, then the call in verse 2 and 3 is to be obedient to those laws. And in our case, of course, the laws of the land, the Constitution, so on and so forth. Now, if you'll notice, as he continues down in the text, and this is the part that was read in verse 4 by Joel, he is God's minister to you for good, but if you do evil, be afraid, for he does not bear the sword in vain, for he is God's minister, an avenger who executes wrath on him who practices evil. And it is based upon that verse, verse 4 of the text, that the contention is made in Romans chapter 13 that capital punishment is acceptable, that it is something that is authorized by God. Of course, there are other examples that we can allude to. For example, under the Old Covenant, there were times when individuals who were guilty of particular crimes were stoned to death. And that was not only authorized, but it was commanded by God for those who are guilty of certain crimes. But most scholars, commentators are in agreement that verse 4, when it says, he does not bear the sword in vain, that is a reference to punishment up to and including capital punishment. That is the taking of life. And that is the what is indicated by the use of the term sword, which would be an instrument to kill, and that the government has the right to do that. Not talking about lynching. We're not talking about something that is not done with due process in accordance with the laws of the land, but something that is authorized by the governing authorities as a response to crime. And so the contention is made, and we'll have opportunity to discuss this some when we get into the questions, but that Romans 13 advocates capital punishment. Yes, sir.
Yeah, skimmed across something or barely touched it, but it's something that was on the mind in regards to these three things. So we see that abortion already is wrong. We see that euthanasia is wrong. We understand that capital punishment is authorized by God. To what extent? It's up to the government. Well, what about self-defense that leads up to such force as is the termination of the life of an attacker? Because I am not in the government. I do not hold the office of executioner. What makes self-defense okay in this case?
Well, actually, when we get down to the eighth question, the very last question,
it's
probably going to be something that we'll be discussing.
There's a difference between murder and killing somebody. It's two different terms, and two differences between the two.
Yes.
Between murder and killing somebody.
Well, you two are in agreement on that.
Yes. Yes, we are.
I know that you are. Yeah, and again, but again, what I don't want to do is to rush through any of this and make assumptions that everybody understands it in that way. We want to go through and do it somewhat systematically.
So sorry, I had to look
that's okay. That's okay. The question is, why does not the sixth commandment of Moses apply to this subject? And I think from that, the idea there would be with regard to capital punishment: thou shalt not kill. And what's under consideration in that call, thou shalt not kill? Because, as you know, when it comes to capital punishment, as an example, those who are against capital punishment will often refer to the sixth commandment as individuals. And then they'll talk about, look at the hypocrisy, these individuals who are saying you can't have an abortion, and yet they're violating the sixth commandment in regard to capital punishment. So we need to define those kinds of things ultimately, the question is this: self-defense can come into it. It's not one of the three that we're mentioning, but self-defense can come in with the rest of this. Is what killing is killing that is sinful and unacceptable to God, and what killing is not sinful and and you kind of hate to say acceptable to God in the sense that God likes it, but approved by God. And of course, it's kind of an interesting thing to see this when you hear about such discussions, because you do have these two groups, those who, let's say, religiously conservative, who will say we're pro-life with regard to abortion, and we're pro-death with regard to capital punishment. And you'll have those who are socially liberal who will say we're pro-death with regard to abortion. Of course, they'll define differently. Pro-life with regard to capital punishment. There's an awful lot of people who are pro-abortion, but they're anti-death penalty, anti-capital punishment. And if you look at it like I look at it, you look at them and think, how in the world could they be for abortion and against capital punishment? That just sounds so peculiar. But you have them over there that are saying, how in the world could you be, against killing a child that's not even born yet, but for killing someone who's already here? That's illogical to
me. I think when you say the word killing and murder, I would classify that for the one child, I would classify that as a murder, not a killer.
Yeah, well, that's the question.
Different. I mean, murder is flat out taking human life.
Sure.
With any regard whatsoever.
Well, and the easiest way to define that, and so that it's very clear, is that God advocated, and in fact, God Himself killed men, has killed men. God is not a murderer.
Right. Exactly.
So not all killing is murder. And that's something I think everyone here, at least, will agree with and understand. So, that's where we distinguish what killing constitutes murder, what killing does not constitute murder. And maybe that's a very simple way of putting it. When is it unlawful killing? When is it lawful killing? And that's the question. And again, you guys know where I stand with regard to these issues, or at least for the most part. So I'm not trying to be in any way obtuse to start off with. I'm just wanting to get it set before us, and then we can systematically examine the issue and some of the passages that we'll deal with. And again, this is what we've talked about, the distinction between innocent life, which must be protected, and duly penalizing the guilty by civil authorities authorized by God. And, of course, that doesn't touch on self-defense because, again, it wasn't something primary. But I think when we get down to at least question number 8, we can bring that up and discuss that as a part of our discussion. Because there are, I mean, like I said, you know, with the Zimmerman case that was recently adjudicated, leading to his not guilty verdict because it was construed by the jury as being self-defense. There are those who are pacifists who believe that killing in self-defense is wrong and sinful. And, of course, others that do not. So that's another question that would fall into these same categories that we're talking about. All right? So that kind of sets the parameters with regard to the article. Like I said, I won't spend a great deal of time on the article because I think the majority of our material in the questions will flesh this out and suit us in our discussion. Did you have something?
Well, I was just going to say that abortion, it's the only one where the person that is killed doesn't have a choice and hasn't done anything wrong. In one where the person kept the punishment and the other one that decides he wants to take his own life. So I just can't understand how anybody could take the position on abortion.
Well, with regard to the question of abortion, the question is going to be, is it life? Is it human life or not? We accept that it is. We want to look at some scriptures that may indicate that to be the case. But, you know, again, just to take, I don't like being the devil's advocate, the devil doesn't need any advocacy, but just to establish a position, they would say that in abortion, that is the one case where it is not human life yet, only human life in potential. And they make that distinction, those who advocate the abortion for various reasons. So, you know, that comes, there's
yeah,
a question.
I think there's something all on the book having to do with when a person is accidentally killed, when the mother's accidentally killed, if the fetus is so many weeks old, it's an individual, or if it's not. Well, it's been 20 years since I had
to go through
deal with that. I can't remember for sure about that.
Yeah, I do know that there are laws in place to where if a woman is attacked and the unborn child is killed, that there can be a charge of murder levied against the individual. I don't know what the parameters of that are.
Yeah, I was going to say, I don't know whether there's a...
How far along she has to be.
How far along, but when you talk about that this law would have 20 weeks, isn't that what it was, 20 weeks?
Yeah, this is 5 months. Yeah, so it's 20 weeks.
Boy, I mean, tell you.
That's And the fact that individuals are so virulently opposed to limiting abortions after 20 weeks is somewhat telling in that regard. And basically what it comes down to, again, this is my understanding of the whole thing, is ultimately what you have is the woman's reproductive rights, that is what is characterized as her right concerning her own body. That's the way they put it, as being put up against the right of the unborn. And for those who advocate this, what they're basically saying is the woman's reproductive rights trump the unborn child. And they will say, many of them will say even up to the point of birth. In other words, there are late-term abortions that are being advocated. They aren't practiced often, but they're there and lawful in some states. And any limitation at all, one of the things that is considered unacceptable by many is to require a minor woman, a girl, let's say a 14-year-old, to give parental permission before having an abortion. Those things are required for many very minor procedures. You can't get your equal without your parents' permission, but you can have an abortion. And the reason for this is because the woman's reproductive rights trump all. And they're against anything that would frighten or intimidate a young lady to where, or preclude her from having the right to make a choice on her own. Nowhere else in society are minors given that kind of ability to make decisions for themselves. But in this one area, for those who advocated it, is paramount. And so it's advocated. So, again, very emotional issues. And while I think we will be pretty much in agreement with regard to these things, I do want to kind of put it out with equanimity so that we can understand that it is certainly something. And the reason why you approach it this way, by the way, one of the things I'm trying to do is to kind of approach it the way we would approach it if we're talking to someone who may differ with us. And the reason this is important, and y'all don't necessarily have to do it, but I'm trying to do it as a teacher to kind of give an example. Because if you just wade in there talking about how all these people who have an abortion or perform abortions are baby murderers, and you can't believe that they would ever even think about such thing, and it's an indication of a debased mind and a seared conscience and all those things, maybe things that you think may be present in many cases in that regard, but you're sure not going to convince anybody of your views and what the Bible teaches on the matter if that's the way you approach it. So if you can acknowledge an understanding of why they feel the way they feel, but then be able to show what's invalid about it with regard to what God says, with regard to what the Bible teaches, and why it's not an acceptable view to have, then you're going to be much more effective in convincing them to perhaps rethink their position than if you go as an antagonist. And by the way, that is a suggestion that I would give to you anytime you're talking to anybody about any issue. Your purpose is not to tell people off, but to correct them so that they can go in. It's always to bring people in, not to run them off. Yes, sir.
It seems very rarely profitable to have a discussion with anyone on this topic. They're very emotionally charged. And if you're someone like me that can be relatively detached from emotion if they want to, that only makes them more upset. And the emotions are high on both sides. And people get frustrated when people try to talk about it systematically or logically. I mean, there have been at least six things said here tonight that are just wrong. They're just factually wrong. And
gee, what are those six things that are factually wrong?
Well,
now I got that same question.
For example, it was stated that abortion is the only case in which the person doesn't have a choice. Well, that's not true. A very common practice is euthanasia of people that are in comas. And those people are not given choices. And so,
okay.
I'm not going to go through all six. It doesn't matter. The point is, I'll go through one more. Another one was, well, one is, you already talked about the definition of abortion up there being a little bit off. But another one was that it was stated abortion is wrong. And while that's often a convenient way to discuss it, it's not precisely right. If you use that definition of abortion, or if you use the definition of abortion that's perhaps a little cleaner, which is abortion is the deliberate termination of a human pregnancy.
So you're making a distinction between those that are an abortion, which, for example, a choice that must be made between the life of the mother and the life of the child, as contrasted
that,
to
that is an example, but perhaps a better example would be God ordering an entire nation to be killed. There was a pregnant lady there somewhere. And so a deliberate termination of a human pregnancy occurred. And so, it gets very emotionally charged, and not only is it often unprofitable to discuss it, because you're not going to get anywhere, but also, if you're going to speak about it precisely, it becomes even less profitable to talk about it.
Well, a couple things, because I understand what you're saying. First of all, we do acknowledge that those are not necessarily the most precise definitions. I think that'll be fleshed out in our discussion. Problem with saying that it's not profitable to discuss it, I think you'll agree with me in regard to this, is that sometimes it becomes necessary to discuss it. Now, I'm right on board with you in saying that, the first thing you ought to do if someone wants to come up to you and talk about abortion and say, hey, we got a lot of other things we need to talk about first, and try to direct their attention to some more fundamental things like what must I do to be saved? You know, that's a primary concern. The situation arises, however, when you have in actuality someone who may be considering or contemplating engaging in some of these kinds of activities. And in a situation like that, it becomes necessary to deal with it. And of course, the teaching needs to be done in general as well. Now, these are frequently asked questions, and this is the point that I was making earlier. You know, just keep in mind when you're discussing these issues with individuals who aren't Christian, that there are things that can be said to turn them off and turn them away from any consideration of truth if you're not careful. And one of the quickest ways of doing that is being dismissive, being arrogant, being emotional yourself in the sense of losing your temper, those kinds of things, being unreasoning, and even something that Justin's indicated, saying things dogmatically that you cannot back up from Scripture or from a fact that you might have. Those are things that we need to be very, very careful about. And by the way, in saying that, I would just give an admonition to the class, because for the most part, I think we're, you know, sometimes we have visitors and all. I've been meaning to say this for some time. There have been a couple of times, not doesn't happen very often, but there have been several times in this class where we've been discussing these frequently asked questions, that I stand up and I either see a visitor in our midst that I know is not Christian, or see someone that I do not know who they are, that they may not be a Christian. And so I, as a teacher, am very, very careful with regard to how I approach it on that night. What I say, how I couch it. You may be shaking your head thinking to yourself, man, why is he going through all of this? Well, if it's something we've already talked about before, or I'm going at it at a snail's pace, or I'm laying a lot of groundwork, look around and see if there's someone here in the congregation, in the class, that you may not recognize, because there may be a reason for what I'm doing. And at the same time, when I'm doing that sometimes, I'll have individuals who will make a comment that would serve to prejudice an individual. Maybe unthinking. You know, we all here are in agreement, so I'm going to say something that could be construed as prejudicial, as being mean-spirited. Not that it actually is, but that it could be construed as such by someone who's here. And that's what we have to kind of keep in mind in all of this. You know, we might say to ourselves, and rightfully so, we're right and they're wrong. We may say to ourselves, you know, he that believes and is baptized shall be saved, he that believes not shall be condemned. It's so plain. No one can misunderstand that unless they wanted to. And we may believe that. And most of the time we're probably right about that. But having said that, that's not the way you're going to approach someone who doesn't believe baptism is necessary for salvation. You're not going to tell them that they're just closed-minded because of a prejudice that they have, and how dare they refuse to accept something that so obviously is true. You're going to try to reason with them in a positive way. Listen to their objections. Listen and try to answer them according to Scripture, and use equanimity in dealing with them, because you're wanting to convert them. You're not wanting to run them off. You're wanting to change their mind. And so, again, kind of keep those things in mind. You know, and I'm not saying there's anything wrong with us when we're talking amongst ourselves to ask that question. How can anyone misunderstand that? How could anyone not get that? It's something so obvious. And we can talk in Romans chapter 1 about individuals who have seared consciences or debased minds, no longer retain God in their knowledge, go through all those kinds of things. But there's a time and a place for those things, and it's important that we be mindful of the times when we're in the presence of those that might would be just without any need offended, when we could state it in a different way and as such perhaps be more effective in trying to convert them. Because we're there to save them, not run them off. That's That's the whole thing. Okay? And I'll tell you, you'll rub plenty of them off by trying to save them. And you're doing it the right way. Without in some way prejudicing the mind because of some kind of an inappropriate statement that you might make in the present. Okay, so I got to admonish everyone. Just keep that in mind. Think about it. Okay? And that gets us through the talk. And so, and again, I know, Justin, you agree with that, that sometimes you got to talk about it. But you're right. These are very emotional things, and you should not expect, if you get on Facebook and someone says, I'm for abortion, to jump right in and from that accomplish much. It's just seldom one to make a difference. And you can try and be as dispassionate and careful with regard to your words as you possibly can be. But just recognize how high the emotions will be on this particular discussion. Okay? Abortion is wrong, euthanasia is wrong, capital punishment is right. I'm going to show you why in our study next week when we get into the discussion questions. Okay? All right. Thank you very much for your kind attention. We'll stop here.